the destroyer take on two larger warships by herself. The Patterson was outnumbered, outgunned, and now pinned by the searchlights of the Tenryu and Yubari. But she was snarling and snapping at the two larger Japanese ships like a rabid dog. Now the 5-inch secondary batteries finally got their chance to fire the star shells. 2 4-gun salvos fired from the port side to illuminate the area beyond the Patterson and hopefully backlight her tormentors so the Chicago's gun director could get a fix on them. But none of the shells ignited. They just plopped into the sea. 2 4-gun salvos from the starboard side, intended to reveal a target behind the Canberra, the Aoba, also failed to burst. A frustrated Captain Bode would later report, "All star shells fired on the first two spreads failed to ignite, apparently because of the failure of the candles to ignite." The Naval War College thought it more likely that the fuses for the star shells had not been set properly. Unfortunately for the Chicago and her crew, the fuses on the Japanese shells were set properly. One such shell, its source unknown, struck the starboard leg of the Chicago's tripod mast and detonated over the forward stack, spreading shrapnel topside, killing 2, and bending the top mast so it interfered with the fire control radar for the main battery director. Unlike the main battery director, the secondary battery director of the Chicago was able to get a fix on a target and thus made itself felt somewhat in the battle between the Patterson and the Japanese 18th Cruiser Division as it reached a rather anticlimactic apex. Unlike the Chicago, the Patterson had gotten her star shells to ignite, silhouetting the Yubari. The destroyer was trading shots using her 5-inch guns at a range of about 5,600 yards. But despite her small size and evasive zigzag maneuvers, she took a hit on the number 4 5-inch mount, which ignited the ready ammunition, killing 10, setting the after part of the ship on fire and knocking the numbers 3 and 4 5-inch mounts offline. The Patterson turned eastward to parallel the two Japanese cruisers, while trying to contain the fire enough to bring the guns back online, but was only successful as to the number 4 gun. Nevertheless, the Patterson managed to get a hit, a 5-inch dud, on the Yubari, who reported some scratches during the night action from the light fire of an enemy destroyer. Now the Chicago entered the fray to a degree, with one of her 5-inch secondary mounts on the port side firing 25 rounds and scoring maybe one hit on the Tenryu. The director then lost track of the cruiser. The main battery director still could not find a target. Captain Bode, frustrated with the inability to find something at which to shoot, took the dangerous but defensible step of ordering the cruiser's searchlights turned on. At 1:51 a.m., 2 searchlights snapped on and scanned the waters off the port side for a moment, but found nothing. Captain Bode was given a report from damage control. The damage to the bow meant the Chicago could not go more than 25 knots without risking the forward bulkheads collapsing like dominoes. But she just kept heading west, slowly, although for no known reason. Gunfire was sighted some 14,000 yards to the west at 2 a.m., apparently 2 ships fighting, but the cruiser could not get close before the flashes petered out, and the ships involved could not be identified. So Howard Bode had effectively abandoned the defenseless transports he was supposed to be protecting. It was a dilemma, a judgment call, head for the gunfire or guard the transports, and Bode was not in the best shape to make that call. Bode, like all the other officers and men in the Allied force, was exhausted mentally and physically. He had been asleep in his emergency cabin when the engagement brought him to the bridge and forced him to immediately assess the situation. Perhaps not knowing where exactly Admiral Crutchley was, Bode may not even have understood he was still in command. The conditions were far from ideal. But war rarely happens under ideal conditions for either side. It is up to the battlefield commander to make the most of whatever hand he has dealt in order to protect and effectively lead his men. On this night, in the midst of battle, Howard Bode got into an argument with his gunnery officer over who should control the radar. He had imposed an overly strict regimen of discipline on the Chicago, which could have and seems to have left many of those under his command so fearful of making a mistake, so tightly wound, that they struggled to function in battle. They did not set the fuses on the star shells properly. They could not find the Japanese at all. They missed a good portion of the battle raging around them. They could not advise Captain Bode for fear of his wrath. Bode was not fighting off the Japanese, had not fought off the Japanese. Neither was he protecting the transports. He had given no orders to the Canberra, Patterson, or Bagley. He had not checked on their status. He had basically left them to fend for themselves, for reasons known only to him. He directed the Chicago to slowly move into a kind of no-man's land, where she could not protect the transports, could not engage the Japanese, could not be any kind of asset in this situation. Most astonishingly, he had told no one outside the Chicago, warned no one, not Captain Reefcole, not the Northern Group, not a superior Admiral Crutchley, not Admiral Turner, that the Imperial Japanese Navy was finally here. Proceed independently. That was what Admiral Mikawa had told the various factions of his cruiser force. It could have easily applied to the Allied Southern Force, given the lack of direction from Captain Bode. The Allied ships were like cows milling in a field. The Canberra was disabled, burning, and adrift. The Chicago was simply wandering to the west. The Bagley was loitering between Savo and Guadalcanal. Hit by the Ubari, the Patterson was snarling like a kicked puppy, fruitlessly looking for someone on which she could exact her revenge. Taking the Admiral's proceed independently order to perhaps a bit of an extreme was the destroyer Yunagi. At the tail end of the main column, the Yunagi had literally been forgotten. Admiral Mikawa had actually seen the Yunagi break off from the column and wondered aloud at the identity of the destroyer. But the Yunagi had a good reason to turn away, because she had seen a nice, fat, juicy target, a light cruiser of the Achilles class, moving slowly, presumably because of the big hole visible near her starboard bow. Maybe, just maybe, the Japanese destroyer could finish her off. But that was no cruiser. That was the destroyer Jarvis, still creeping across the battlefield, apparently only dimly aware of what was going on around her. The Yunagi overtook the damaged American destroyer on her starboard quarter, and at 1:55 a.m. brought her guns to bear. Though wounded, the Jarvis still had some bite to her, however, and replied with gunfire of her own. This short exchange was witnessed by the Chicago, who doesn't seem to have done anything about it. The Yunagi was not hit or damaged, but claimed to have hit the Jarvis. Whether she did or not will never be known. Perhaps surprised at the amount of return fire from, and maybe a bit intimidated by, this cruiser, at about 2 a.m., the Yunagi broke off the gun duel and headed north to rejoin her comrades when they completed their trek around Savo and passed north of the island on their way out. So the Jarvis was left to continue what was never intended to be her own lonely trek, hugging the coast of Guadalcanal. She simply wanted to be left alone. But 50 minutes later, after she had rounded Cape Esperance and began heading south, another ship began tailing her. The Jarvis sped up as much as she dared, but the mysterious ship closed to about 500 yards and issued a visual challenge. It was the U.S. destroyer Blue. The Naval War College would later say that on this night, the Blue was not vigilant, at least on certain bearings. True enough, though she had seen flares and flashes of gunfire around Savo Island, the same alleged watchdog destroyer that had completely missed 7 Japanese cruisers and 1 Japanese destroyer pass within a mile of her, the Blue had similarly completely missed the approach of the Jarvis, only seeing the crippled destroyer after she had passed and actually crossed the Blue's line of sight to that all-important Cape Esperance. The Jarvis was ominously leaving a large oil slick, quite visible to the Blue even on this darkest of nights. Using her Aldis lamp, the Blue told the Jarvis she was trailing oil. The Jarvis replied that she was aware of it. The Blue signaled, "Are you all right?" And, lying, the Jarvis answered, "Affirmative." The Blue went on to resume her watch, if one could call it that. The Jarvis slowly crawled away to the south, one lonely destroyer, the smallest of all men of war, crippled and barely clinging to life, proceeding independently, proceeding alone, in the dark, out to sea. The dark has a way of pulling apart even the best-led, the best-trained combatants, and Admiral Mikawa's force was no exception. After his attack on the southern force, Mikawa had the column turn northeast, initially heading for the transports at Tulagi. But he had seen the northern group of cruisers, and knew he could not go after the transports with 3 U.S. Navy heavy cruisers in his rear, blocking his exit. He had to take care of them first. So the flagship Chokai had led the 6th Cruiser Division in a turn to the north to continue rounding Savo Island counterclockwise. The Furutaka, the last ship in the 6th Cruiser Division's column, was not with them. Her steering difficulties had pulled her out of the column well to starboard. She tried to turn back to rejoin her sister ships, but the disabled Canberra drifted in the way. Apparently steering with her engines, the Furutaka turned to port, due north, to avoid a collision, then gave the helpless Australian ship a blasting with her main and secondary armament. Still, she couldn't rejoin the main Japanese column. Enter the rabble of the 18th Cruiser Division. The Tenryu and Yubari had just finished their duel with the Patterson, believing they had sunk her, when the Furutaka came up on a collision course with the Yubari. Admiral Matsuyama ordered an immediate line turn to port, and both Tenryu and Yubari turned at roughly the same time. Tenryu had turned her gunfire on the Bagley and thought she had heavily damaged the destroyer. The Bagley was not hit, and had never even realized someone was shooting at her. The Yubari would have joined in this effort to get the Bagley's attention, but her range was followed by the Furutaka, who now fell in behind the Tenryu. They were now completely separated from the main Japanese column. How they could rejoin was not clear. If they tried to do so, they risked running into the northern group of Allied cruisers or fouling the eastern group's line of fire. This was not exactly how Admiral Mikawa had planned it. The once simple column of Japanese cruisers was now two groups, an eastern one with the Chokai, Aoba, Kako, and Kinugasa all in column, and a western one with the Tenryu leading the Furutaka and the Yubari slightly to port. Both were east of Savo Island, heading north on parallel courses. It was on the Chokai, leading the more eastern of those brackets, where one of those sharp-eyed Japanese lookouts had, in the dark, made a startling discovery. Her executive officer, Kato Kenkichi, would later explain, "When the Chokai approached the enemy, the main battery of the first ship we saw, which I think was the last ship in the column, was not trained on either of our groups of ships." The 8-inch gun turrets of all the U.S. cruisers, not just the Astoria, which was the ship Kato mentioned, but also the Quincy and Vincennes, were trained in, the forward turrets all facing directly forward, the aft turrets all facing directly aft, as if they were in port. Clearly oblivious to the Japanese presence, again, the U.S. Navy cruisers were about to be bracketed by enemies. The aircraft flares that had backlit the southern group for the Japanese were in the wrong direction for illuminating the northern force, but that in itself was not a major problem. The Japanese had very good searchlights and were very good at using them. Captain Kato would say the crews went into battle very easy-mindedly, without any worries. At 1:48 a.m., the Chokai launched 4 torpedoes. 2 minutes later, Admiral Mikawa gave the order for the main guns to open fire. The searchlight of the Chokai snapped on, an intense blinding beam that caught the last cruiser in the Allied column. No, it was not as Admiral Mikawa had planned it, but it would work better than he could have imagined. 2 arms headed for the northern group of Allied cruisers, ready to give them the embrace of death. At midnight, Lieutenant Commander William Truesdell had come on duty as the gunnery officer for the U.S. cruiser Astoria. A figure who was either loved or hated aboard the cruiser, Truesdell was nevertheless well-respected and something of a stickler for being prepared. He took his post in the forward main battery control station and noticed the forward fire control radar seemed to be malfunctioning. Specifically, the display was about half its horizontal size. Otherwise, it was functioning normally. The technicians had decided they could not identify and fix the problem at night with the ship blacked out, so they would wait until morning. Truesdell insisted it be fixed immediately. At 1:45 a.m., the technicians began work on the radar and had it fixed within a few minutes. Truesdell tested it on the other ships in the group to satisfy himself that it was indeed fixed. Radar was proving to be a continuous problem on the Astoria. The after-fire control radar was already out because of a shorted transformer, and no replacement parts for it were available at sea. According to Skipper Captain William Garrett Greenman, the search radar was not of much use either. "What we got only led to confusion," he later said. The officer on watch and radar frequently reported to me early in the evening that he was picking up strange objects in the area where these ships were supposed to be. Greenman decided that those strange objects were indeed ships, his comrades in the screening force. Up on the Astoria's bridge, Lieutenant Commander James Topper, the senior officer on watch, had just overseen the cruiser's course change at 1:44 a.m. to a northwesterly course, following the Quincy and Vincennes on this leg of the box patrol. Except Topper thought he had just felt a slight tremor. Probably a destroyer dropping depth charges some distance away, he presumed. Maybe a submarine had managed to sneak into the harbor and was going after the transports. But he could find nothing amiss among either the transport groups or other ships. Topper told everyone to be alert. Then the lookouts reported they could hear a plane overhead, but they could not see it. Lieutenant Commander Topper went to the starboard side of the bridge to hear for himself, but his investigation was interrupted by the voice radio, which carried an order from the Vincennes. The cruisers were having navigational issues in the dark and had strayed from their intended course on the box patrol. If there were indeed submarines inside the perimeter, maintaining their proper course and station in the formation was important to preserve the anti-submarine protection of the destroyers. To help get back on course, Captain Reefcole was delaying the next turn in the box patrol for 10 minutes, from 1:50 a.m. to 2 a.m. In acknowledging this order, the Astoria missed the second warning issued by the Patterson. Someone on the port side of the bridge reported seeing star shells off the port quarter. Lieutenant Commander Topper saw that they were not star shells, but aircraft flares about 5,000 yards away. He sent for the captain and prepared for general quarters, and was shocked by a tremendous boom and an accompanying concussive shock. Without warning, the Astoria's main guns had fired a salvo. "This gave me quite a surprise," Topper later wrote, "as I had not given an order about opening fire, nor could I make out any ships in the vicinity of the flares." General quarters sounded as the 5-inch secondary battery fired a salvo of its own. Lieutenant Commander Topper could not see any ships, but Lieutenant Commander Truesdell could. He had seen the aircraft flares and knew exactly what they meant. Truesdell had run back to his station just in time to see the shell splashes off the port bow from the first Japanese salvo fired by the flagship Chokai at a range of 7,000 yards. It had missed, but was only 500 yards to port and 200 yards ahead. The time was 1:50 a.m. "All stations alert," came the order to the gun crews from Lieutenant Commander Truesdell. Reacting quickly and completely in line with his training, a rare feat on this night, Truesdell put his men at battle stations and trained the Astoria's gun director to port, along with all three main turrets. The lookouts reported three cruisers of the Nachi class. Truesdell thought he saw four on the radar screen. He requested general quarters and permission to open fire. There was no reply. At 1:51 a.m., there were more shell splashes, 500 yards to port, but ahead by only 100 yards. A second salvo from the Chokai. She was zeroing in on the Astoria. Lieutenant Commander Truesdell was mystified as to why general quarters was not sounding when very clearly enemy ships were shooting at them. He made a second request, but again, no reply. He could wait no longer. "Commence firing!" At least 8 of the Astoria's 9 8-inch guns fired, followed by all of the port 5-inch guns. More shell splashes, dead on, but still 500 yards to port. The Chokai's salvos were getting closer to the mark. "What are you firing at? Cease firing!" came the order from the bridge. Still groggy from his aborted nap, Captain Greenman had arrived at the bridge and was puzzled as to why his ship was at general quarters firing its guns. "Who sounded the general alarm? Who gave the order to commence firing?" Topper replied that he had done neither. Seeing the flares and maybe 2 searchlights, Captain Greenman arrived at the conclusion that the Allied ships had sighted a surfaced Japanese submarine and were shooting at it. He couldn't see any submarine, but that didn't mean anything. There couldn't be enemy ships inside the harbor, which meant the Astoria was shooting at Allied ships. "Topper, I think we are firing on our own ships," said Captain Greenman. "Let's not get too excited and act too hastily. Cease firing." Lieutenant Commander Topper agreed with his assessment. Except it just wasn't adding up to that. Captain Greenman had shell splashes 500 yards to port, the third salvo from the Chokai. He saw shell splashes straddle the Vincennes. A member of the bridge crew, on the internal phone with the gunnery officer, declared, "Mr. Truesdell said, for God's sake, give the word to commence firing." Captain Greenman could now see fire from at least 5 ships. There were more shell splashes, this time only 200 yards to port, close enough that an 8-inch shell struck the Astoria well forward, passing through the paint locker without causing a fire. The Chokai's 4th salvo. She was getting ever closer. After a single minute that felt like an hour, Captain Greenman finally got the hint. He remarked, "Our ships are not. We will have to stop them." Lieutenant Commander Topper would later explain, "I believe this remark was caused by the splashes that had just landed ahead and to port of the Astoria." As far as battlefield speeches go, it left room for improvement, but Greenman next shouted, "Sound general quarters, commence firing." Lieutenant Commander Truesdell immediately complied by firing all 6 guns of the 2 forward turrets at the Chokai, the Astoria's 3rd salvo. The 8-inch shells fell only about 100 yards short. He was close. But the Chokai had the element of surprise and Captain Greenman's indecision, giving her a head start and getting her shells on their target. And that head start paid off. At 1:55 a.m., when the Chokai's 5th salvo landed at least 4 8-inch shells amidships on the Astoria. The direct recipients of the Japanese flagship's largesse were the Astoria's boat deck and the hangar, where she kept her SOC Seagull floatplanes. Now the wisdom of Admiral Mikawa's decision to jettison all flammable and inflammable materials topside was shown. By contrast, the Astoria's floatplanes were supposed to be drained of their fuel every night, but the crews grumbled about this duty, and the aircraft were scheduled for an early morning mission anyway, so each carried 175 gallons of volatile aviation fuel. The hangar and catapult area was a fire marshal's nightmare. Not only did each Seagull carry that aviation fuel it should not have had, but the planes themselves were wood and fabric. Their fuel and ammunition were also stored in the hangar. A kerosene tank was nearby. It all meant that when the Chokai shells hit, midships on the Astoria became an inferno. No longer could the Astoria try to hide herself in the darkness. No longer could she even hope that any evasive maneuvers would be effective, because she now unwillingly carried a giant torch. The Chokai now shut off her searchlights, eliminating her own bright points of aim in the night. The Astoria's midships fire was now a giant glowing target for the Japanese gunners. Captain Greenman received an order from the Vincennes to increase speed to 15 knots. 15 knots in a battle? He ordered speed increased to 20 knots and a turn to port. With the Japanese column speeding at 26 knots, about to pass some 4 miles astern of the U.S. column, between the northern force and the transports they were supposed to protect, the 2 forward turrets were reaching the limit of their train, their ability to rotate to port. Lieutenant Commander Truesdell had begged the bridge to turn to port to keep the Japanese within their firing arcs. Turret 3, the aft turret, the turret that was most able to fire on the Japanese, lost power as a result of the fire, but it could have been worse. And it quickly was. At 1:56 a.m., 3 8-inch shells, believed to have come from the Chokai, hit the forward number 1 turret. One penetrated the faceplate and detonated in the gunroom, killing everyone there and destroying the interior of the turret. The other 2 penetrated the barbette, killing all but 2 in the upper powder room and the shell deck. Turret number 1 was now permanently disabled, and another fire was burning on the Astoria. In response came the Astoria's 4th salvo, only 2 shells from the only functioning turret, number 2. They missed. Now that she had the range, the Chokai apparently went to rapid fire with her 8-inch guns. The Kinugasa joined in the carnage, and for the Astoria, now the real agony began. The Astoria was in the curious position of being the last ship in the Northern Force to go to general quarters, but the first to fire at the Japanese. The Quincy, just ahead of her, had been the first to go to battle stations, but she had been having communications problems all night. They certainly did not get better now. She had received the second warning from the Patterson, but it was never passed to the main battery control. At 1:46 a.m., lookouts had spotted 3 dark silhouettes to the southwest, one with 3 turrets forward. Since no American cruiser had 3 turrets forward, they decided that these ships were probably Japanese. But apparently this information also never reached main battery control, or for that matter, the bridge. Nevertheless, when she received that second warning from the Patterson at 1:47 a.m., the supervisor of the watch, Lieutenant Commander Edward E. Billings, had the Quincy go to general quarters and skipper Captain Samuel Nobra Moore was called to the bridge. He arrived just as the cruiser was pinned in Japanese searchlights, those of the Aoba, operating just behind the Chokai in the Japanese Eastern Column. But these could be friendly ships seeking that curiously unseen Japanese submarine that everyone thought had penetrated the harbor. So Captain Moore ordered the recognition lights, colored lights up either side of the bridge that identified the ship as American, turned on. This was a bad idea. Next, Captain Moore asked his officer of the deck, Lieutenant Charles P. Clark, Jr., which way he should turn. Clark answered, to the right. This was to try to clear the supposedly friendly ships, illuminating them. Moore asked again, and Clark gave the same reply. Another bad idea, of which on this night the Allies had no shortage. The shells were now starting to fall. The lookouts could see shell splashes near the Astoria, the Chokai's first salvo having fallen short, and near the Vincennes, the first salvo from the Kako also having fallen short. Captain Moore was saved from acting on his own misunderstanding by orders which came in from the Vincennes over the voice radio. Steam at standard speed, 15 knots, and fire on the searchlights. So the skipper appropriately directed his gunners to fire on the searchlights. A good idea, at long last. The gunnery crews had been completely in the dark about the situation and the sounding of battle stations until the Aoba literally shone the light on them at 1:50 a.m. Nevertheless, a minute later, fire control quickly got a fix on the Aoba's searchlight, 8,400 yards, for the Quincy's 8-inch guns to open fire. And nothing. No earth-shattering kaboom, no concussion, no flash from the Quincy's 8-inch guns. The Quincy was now bracketed by shell splashes. The first 8-inch salvo from the Aoba had landed off the port bow, the second some 200 yards off the starboard side, and still nothing from the Quincy's 8-inch guns. At 1:52 a.m., the Aoba finally got a hit with her third salvo, well aft on the Quincy, and starting a fire on the fantail, which was quickly contained. Still, no response from Quincy's 8-inch guns. A minute later came the Aoba's fourth salvo of 8-inch shells, which hit the bridge, accomplishing more damage to personnel than to material, and wounded several persons, in the words of the Naval War College. Still nothing from the Quincy's 8-inch guns. Though the Quincy's main armament was having obvious issues, the cruiser's secondary armament was trying to get in the game. In an attempt to illuminate the cruiser's tormentor, star shells were loaded into the four portside 5-inch guns, but no order to fire them was received. Those communications issues again, and the guns simply sat there, loaded, just long enough for the Aoba's next salvo at 1:54 to hit the guns, setting off the star shells like Roman candles, as well as the nearby ready ammunition. The guns were wrecked, and most of the personnel killed. The Japanese Eastern Column was moving astern of the Northern Force. If the U.S. cruisers wanted to keep the Japanese cruisers within the firing arcs of their forward guns, they would have to turn. Seeing the Vincennes about 600 yards ahead make a sharp turn to port, Captain Moore immediately had the Quincy turn to port as well. Thus, the Japanese remained within the firing arcs of all 9 8-inch guns. Now, if only those guns would fire. Less than a minute later, the Aoba's sixth salvo hit the Quincy's well deck, where it set one of the cruiser's Seagull floatplanes afire. Burning gasoline was sprayed all over the well deck, boat deck, and a floatplane on the port catapult. "Shoot it off!" screamed Captain Moore. He wanted the explosive charges normally used to catapult the plane into the air detonated, to instead blow off its flaming carcass into the sea. But the order was never carried out, and the fire soon spread to the starboard catapult, the floatplane located there, and everywhere amidships. Enemy gunfire had set a floatplane on fire yet again, just like the Astoria. But unlike those of the Astoria, the Quincy's guns had yet to fire a shot. A full 8 minutes after she had gone to battle stations, some 5 minutes after she had first been under enemy fire. Captain Moore fumed. The Aoba shut off her searchlight, and for the Quincy now the real agony began. It was remarkable that on this night, when the Allies were plagued by assumptions and errors, inference and incompetence, Captain Reefcole of the Vincennes, the officer in tactical command of the Northern Group, had received the report of the Japanese cruisers and seaplane tenders or gunboats, and had actually calculated that if those ships had wanted to reach Guadalcanal, they could do so that night. Equally remarkable was that Reefcole did next to nothing about it. only making an order to a few on the Vincennes to keep a lookout for approaching enemy ships between midnight and 2 a.m., and to make an all-around sweep with the search radar. He said nothing more to the crew of the Vincennes, and nothing at all to the other ships of the Northern Group. Then he went to bed, after nearly 21 hours on the bridge, for some inarguably badly needed sleep. Captain Reefcole was awakened 45 minutes later. The lookouts had noticed some curious things. Flares had appeared over the area of the transports, gunfire had been spotted, and some ships were silhouetted by a great display of light southeast of Savo Island. Arriving at the bridge, Reefcole took a look for himself. The skipper could see the flares, and a battle going on to the south between two ships who were shooting star shells to try to illuminate each other, later determined to be the Patterson exchanging fire with the Yubari. Seeing no other ships or heavy gunfire, and having received no communications from either Admiral Crutchley or the Southern Force, the Patterson's warning had reached the Vincennes radio room but not the bridge, for reasons known only to the communications personnel, he surmised that the Southern Group had intercepted a Japanese destroyer trying to penetrate the harbor. The destroyer must be a diversion, to lure his ships to the south and leave the North Channel unguarded for the main force of Japanese ships to plow through and attack the transports. But Captain Reefcole would not be fooled so easily. His ships would stay right where they were, and continue their box patrol. Surely the Southern Group could handle a single destroyer. Nonetheless, Captain Reefcole ordered the Vincennes, but not the rest of the Northern Force, to battle stations at 1:48 a.m. With no information aside from what his lookouts reported, and no direction from Admiral Crutchley, he was plagued by indecision. Reefcole considered shooting up star shells, but those would reveal his position and might illuminate the Southern Force. He wanted to position his ships to best oppose an enemy charge through the North Channel, which meant it should turn to starboard. But turning to starboard took him further away from the Southern Force, which may need his help. He chose to increase speed to 15 knots, but keep his current course to await developments, or, better yet, orders. And so the Northern Force was still cruising northwest when at 1:50, Captain Reefcole saw off to his port quarter a pair of searchlights snap on, shining on the Astoria. 20 seconds later came another pair, shining on the Quincy. 20 seconds more, and there was a third pair, shining on the Vincennes. Captain Reefcole presumed it was the Southern Force, chasing that destroyer, which was doing quite the opposite of clearing out the North Channel. Politely, the Vincennes radioed these unexpected visitors, "Turn those searchlights off of us. We are friendly." Not quite as politely, the unexpected visitors responded with an avalanche of 8-inch shells, the Chokai firing at the Astoria, the Aoba firing at the Quincy, and now the Kako firing her first salvo at the Vincennes, landing some 500 yards off the port beam. Captain Reefcole looked to port and saw a long line of gunfire seemingly aimed at him. He was starting to reach the conclusion that these ships were not the Southern Force, not even friendly, though not convinced enough to stop the Vincennes radio room from continuously broadcasting, "We are friendly." He ordered star shells to be fired to attempt to illuminate their tormentors. Gunnery officer Lieutenant Commander Robert Lee Adams responded with a salvo from the 5-inch guns. At the same time, the Kako's second salvo landed only about 100 yards short. "Open fire on targets of opportunity," Captain Reefcole ordered his gunners. But for the Japanese, the Vincennes was already the target of opportunity. At 1:52 a.m., the Kako fired her next salvo from both her main and secondary armament. The Vincennes took a 5-inch shell on the bridge that killed the communications officer and several others. She also took several hits amidships, in the carpenter shop, and in the hangar. The float planes had been drained of fuel, but the planes themselves were still wood and fabric, and they caught fire, which gave the Vincennes her own illuminating flaming torch. The Kako shut off her searchlights, and for the Vincennes, now the real agony began. All three heavy cruisers of the Northern Force had thus been branded not with a scarlet letter, but with a glowing target, courtesy of their own float planes. They could no longer hide from the Japanese. Conversely, the fires helped hide the Japanese. The flames and smoke ruined night vision and fouled sighting and range finding on the American ships, while the Japanese, having no more need of their searchlights, had turned them off and thus robbed the Americans of any point of aim for their guns. Indeed, the American guns were struggling to make their presence felt. At 1:53, the Vincennes finally got her first salvo off. 9 8-inch shells directed at the cockle. It was 500 yards short, largely because she had gotten her firing solution off the Chokai's searchlight. Her gunners recalculated. The cockles did not, and the Vincennes took several hits in her antenna trunk, knocking out her searchlights, communications, and temporarily power to the gun control equipment. Captain Reefcole, the officer in tactical command of the Northern Force, presented his gunnery officer, Lieutenant Commander Adams, with the question of, "What do you suggest now?" Lieutenant Commander Adams replied, "Let's get out of here until we can see what we are doing. I'm not sure of my targets." Captain Reefcole told his gun crews, "Cease firing. I'm going to swing around. When we come back in, we'll give them hell." The Vincennes increased speed to 20 knots, or tried to anyway, and turned 40 degrees to port in an effort to keep the Japanese not rapidly passing astern within the firing arcs of her forward turrets, but also surrendering to them a position between her and the transports she was supposed to be protecting. By the time power had been restored to her fire control, another target had appeared, the Kunugasa. As the fourth and last cruiser in the Japanese Eastern Column, she did not have an opposite number among the Northern Force cruisers and was trying to decide on a target. Despite the fact that her most likely targets were all illuminated by fires, the Kunugasa continued to use her searchlights. A 9-gun salvo from the Vincennes, her second, detonated in her port steering room. Her steering control temporarily disabled, the Kunugasa stumbled out of the column to port. Having learned the error of her ways, the Kunugasa shut off her searchlights, and the Vincennes lost her target. Captain Reefcole tried to shift his target back to the Kako, but he found the Vincennes' port turn had not been enough to keep the Kako within the forward turret's firing arcs. So he turned back to starboard to try to parallel the Japanese. While in this turn, at 1:55, the Vincennes suffered an underwater explosion on the port side underneath sick bay. Reefcole thought she had been hit by a torpedo from a submarine. He was half right. The cruiser's starboard turn took her close to her original course from when the battle started and into the path of the torpedoes the Chokai had launched before opening gunfire on the northern group. One of those torpedoes had hit. Things went downhill even more quickly. The shell hits kept coming. The Vincennes lost power to her main guns. Two were able to run off backup generators, but turret two had to be operated by hand. Steering had to be moved aft after the bridge lost steering control. At least three shells struck aft near the backup command center known as Battle 2 that was manned during battle and commanded by the executive officer. The salvo ended up killing most of the personnel there, smashing the station, and actually blowing the aft 5-inch director overboard. Damage to the fire rooms was costing the Vincennes more and more engine power, and with most internal communications destroyed, Captain Reefcole was unable to give steering instructions from the bridge to the after-steering engine room. The Vincennes finally lost sight of the eastern column of Japanese cruisers at 2 o'clock, only to have the battle cross from injurious to insulting by taking fire from the Furutaka and the Yubari of the western section of Japanese cruisers to port. Illuminating by searchlight, the Furutaka used her 8-inch main guns and 4.7-inch secondary guns to pummel the Vincennes further, knocking out the remaining fire control position and forcing the guns to go local control, meaning the individual turrets and mounts had to sight their own targets, determine the range and deflection, and fire on their own. The Yubari sent a low-order detonation torpedo into the Vincennes' port side, destroying the number one fire room and killing everyone in it. The Vincennes' forward engine room took a shell hit that ruptured the main steam line. With the loss of the last of the steam pressure, the engine rooms were abandoned, and the Vincennes lost all propulsive power. Desperate for help from any quarter, Reefcole watched as his two screening destroyers, Helm and Wilson, whom he had earlier ordered to carry out a torpedo attack, nearly collided with each other. The Helm did try to carry out the attack, charging all by herself at an unidentified ship in the gloom southwest of Savo Island. As she prepared to launch torpedoes, a lightning flash illuminated her target. It was the Bagley, who had never sighted the Helm. The Eastern Group cruisers continued to fire on the Vincennes from starboard, disabling both forward turrets and knocking down the American flag with shell hits. Finding this gunfire rather irritating, Captain Reefcoal tried to use the Vincennes' remaining momentum to turn to port, where the Furutaka and the Ubari were still pounding him. Incredibly, the captain ordered another American flag run up from the starboard yardarm and illuminated. He still thought the ships shooting at him from starboard were friendly. The Naval War College found this difficult to understand. In fairness, though, when the flag went up, the Furutaka and Ubari quit shooting, turned off their searchlights, and sailed off. But it was too late for the Vincennes. Powerless, afire, adrift, and listing badly to port from the torpedo hits, the cruiser was doomed. Curiously, the Chokai shone her searchlight on the disabled cruiser and fired on her for a few minutes, but it was superfluous. At 2:16 a.m., Captain Reefcoal gave the order to prepare to abandon ship. As the cruiser continued to heel over to port, the order to abandon ship was given at 2:30 a.m. 20 minutes later, the Vincennes slid into the deep, her foremast striking the water just a few feet from where Captain Reefcoal was swimming desperately to get away. The Chokai's actions here are part of her own little mystery. She had broken away from the main Japanese eastern column around 2 a.m. and wandered off northeast toward Tulagi. The Aoba, Kako, and Kinugasa had not followed, but had continued heading north, engaging the northern group and also placing themselves between the northern group and the Chokai, who later had to chase after the 6th Cruiser Division like a puppy chasing after its owner. Why the Chokai did this is unknown. Admiral Mikawa later indicated it was planned, but the course information for the Chokai during this period was curiously absent from her after-action report, suggesting a cover-up. The Naval War College thought she may have been having steering troubles, and that her use of her searchlight may have been to try to establish her bearings and find her cohorts. It may sound like a small matter, but it would have outsized consequences. Thanks to the Quincy. Captain Moore's ship could no longer see the eastern group of Japanese cruisers who had killed their searchlights. As if that did not blind her to her tormentors enough, the midship's fire on the cruiser had fouled her fire control stations and forced the evacuation of the after stations. The smoke from the blazing Vincennes ahead of her made it worse still. But at 1:56 a.m., she was finally able to see through the smoke a light, a searchlight to be precise, had snapped on from the southwest. Her exasperated skipper and gunnery officer were elated, and for the first time in this battle, the Quincy got off a 9-gun salvo from her main armament. It missed, but her 8-inch guns had finally fired after a sickening 8-minute interlude since the ship had gone to battle stations. The absurd length of time it took for the Quincy's main guns to fire was the subject of considerable comment in the Naval War College's post-mortem of the battle. The issue for the Quincy was not poor performance by her skipper, her officers, and men, or any problem with her equipment. Rather, it was organizational. The Quincy had just transferred to the Pacific from the Atlantic, where there were standing orders to keep the secondary guns manned at night in case they came across a surfaced German U-boat. It made sense for operations in the Atlantic, flooded as it was by German U-boats that were employed strategically, but not in the Pacific, where the Japanese operated their submarines quite differently. No one had thought to change it when she came to the Pacific. For purposes of this engagement, this difference might not have mattered, except when the Quincy went to battle stations, those crewmen manning the guns had to move to their battle stations elsewhere, while others had to come in to man the guns. There was a similar issue with communications personnel. The result was that when the Quincy went to battle stations, a lot of men were running from one station to the other. When the watertight doors and hatches were closed and dogged down, their movement was slowed to a crawl. So her battle stations were not fully manned for a period of time that was utterly ridiculous, and since they were under fire from the Japanese, deadly, which more than adequately described the Quincy's predicament. The searchlight they had just seen was not the ship that had been firing on them all along, the Aoba, but a different one, from a group to the southwest. It belonged to the cruiser Furutaka. The Quincy's lookouts then spotted gunfire from a ship with 3 stacks ahead of the Furutaka, the Tenryu. Admiral Mikawa's unintentional embrace of death had clutched the Quincy close to its bosom, and Captain Moore realized he was caught in a crossfire between 2 groups of Japanese cruisers. Seeing the Vincennes make a wobbly turn to starboard, Moore turned to starboard as well. He snarled at his gunnery officer, "We are going through the middle. Give them hell." His plan was that the Quincy's aft turret would deal with the Furutaka, while the forward turrets could fire on the eastern group. In this, he would be disappointed. An 8-inch shell from the Furutaka hit the aft turret's faceplate and jammed it in train. It seemed nothing could go right on this night for the Allies. Once the Quincy in her turn had cleared the flaming Astoria, Captain Moore had the starboard 5-inch guns fire a salvo of star shells. The forward turrets were to fire on anything the star shells revealed, but the salvo burst short of any targets and above the clouds, so they provided no illumination. Two subsequent ones also burst above the clouds. Moore tried to aim the searchlights, but communications broke down and his orders never got through. Fortunately, if one could call finding targets shooting at one fortunate, three sets of searchlights had been spotted to the south, the Aoba leading the Kako and Kinugasa. The Aoba had switched from pounding the Quincy to pounding the Astoria, but in her turn to starboard, the flaming, struggling Quincy looked to the Aoba like she was making a kamikaze run at them. She was a brave ship, manned by brave men, Captain Omai would later say. A suicide run was always guaranteed to get the Japanese attention, so the Aoba switched her guns back. The American cruiser took another vicious salvo that knocked out a fire room, her forward anti-aircraft director, and most of her starboard guns. The Quincy responded with her second 8-inch salvo. The Aoba shot off her searchlight before the shells landed, over in range. Behind the now surrounded ship, the ancient, ugly Tenryu, off the western group, was starting to get her licks in, and devastating licks they were, too. She launched a volley of torpedoes that ran for about 2 minutes before at least two of them buried themselves into the Quincy's port side, destroying two fire rooms and slowing her further. A salvo from the light cruiser knocked out the Battle II's secondary command center. The Quincy was now a staggering inferno, sinking, surrounded, taking shots from all directions, yet unable to see who was doing the shooting. She was desperate for a target to dish out just a little of what had been so brutally served to her. And a target appeared. A new set of searchlights off her starboard quarter farther to the southeast. Her six remaining functional 8-inch guns let loose for only their third salvo, their final defiance, at these mysterious lights. A lookout saw the target burst into flames, backlighting another cruiser, apparently the Kako, crossing in front of her and badly separated from the other Japanese cruisers for some reason. The lookout didn't realize they'd just hit Admiral Mikawa's flagship, Chokai. One 8-inch shell hit the near aviation crane, but Admiral Mikawa had had the foresight to dump all flammable objects and had launched his planes, or the Chokai would have had a burning scout plane like the Vincennes, Quincy, and Astoria did. As a result, the hit was not serious. The other two 8-inch shells hit just aft of the bridge in the flag operations room, about 15 feet from Mikawa himself. The explosion left the Admiral, Captain Omai, and the rest of the staff shocked and disconcerted momentarily, but it was not a serious hit. Nevertheless, inasmuch as it burned up all the navigational charts, it was a very annoying one. The Quincy could only wish the response was limited to annoying. At 2:06 a.m., a devastating blast from the Aoba smashed the starboard side of the bridge and cleared the pilot house, killing or mortally wounding everyone there. Lieutenant Commander Billings, who had brought the ship to battle stations, staggered to the starboard wing of the bridge, half of his face gone, and collapsed in the arms of Lieutenant Clark, reassuring, "I'm all right, I'm all right. Keep calm. Everything will be all right. The ship will go down fighting." The junior officer of the deck, Lieutenant J.G. J.H. Mee, Jr., and Lieutenant J.G. Douglas C. Scaife, ran onto the bridge and found Captain Moore slumped to the right of wheel. "Transfer control to Bat 2," the skipper groaned. A signalman came in and took over the wheel. Mee ran around trying to get in touch with Battle 2, not knowing it had already been destroyed. The list of things destroyed on the Quincy was rapidly lengthening. At about the same time the bridge was hit, a shell running on an almost flat trajectory passed through, appropriately enough, the shell deck and hit the barbette of Turret 1, damaging the turret so badly it could not fire. Turret 1 took two more hits in quick succession and had to be abandoned. Turret 2 took a hit near the top of the barbette, setting the ammunition on fire and leaving the turret ablaze, to explode a few minutes later with such ferocity that the executive officer on the Astoria thought the Quincy herself had exploded. With both the guns and the fire control stations now disabled, Assistant Gunnery Officer Lieutenant Commander John D. Andrew went to the bridge to ask for instructions. He found the pilot house a slaughterhouse. Bodies and pieces of bodies strewn about in often grotesque positions, windows smashed, blood everywhere. The only sign of life was the signalman still at the wheel, now spinning it in a futile effort to turn the ship left. He turned to Andrew. "The captain is dead," he said. "He told me to beach the ship, but I can't steer." As he finished, Captain Moore half rose from the deck and, moaning, collapsed for the final time. His ship had only a few moments more, blazing like a furnace, badly listing, communications so bad no one knew who was in command, helplessly meandering to starboard, no longer aware of what was going on around her. The equally blazing Astoria, heading the opposite direction, was barely able to avoid a collision. A late torpedo hit at 2:16 to starboard from the Aoba flooded her fire room and cost the Quincy what little power she had left, but was otherwise redundant. Her bow awash, the Quincy completed her roll to port and sank at 2:38. The Astoria was blazing in more ways than one. In the unfortunate position of being the last cruiser in a column whose T was being crossed astern by the Japanese, she had taken the brunt of the gunfire from the Japanese eastern cruisers and could only respond with turret 3. At 2:01, the cruiser Kako had launched 4 torpedoes, which missed. The Astoria could not respond in kind because of the unbelievably stupid decision by the U.S. Navy to remove the torpedoes from their cruisers. Captain Greenman had turned to starboard to bring the turret 2 to bear on eastern cruisers, she was apparently unaware of the western group, and to clear the line of fire of the Quincy, but the Quincy unexpectedly turned right as well, so Greenman had to turn the Astoria more than he had wanted or expected to try to clear the Quincy's line of fire. It meant that the Astoria continued to take the bulk of the gunfire. Of that gunfire, she had taken only 2 worrying shell hits to her hull, both 8-inch hits that had punched holes in the hull in the second deck above the waterline. So the Astoria was structurally sound, more or less, and would remain so if the damage did not get any worse from combat or the fires blazing on and inside her. Though she was blazing from her foremast to her hangar, her remaining 8-inch guns were blazing too, in a different sense, thanks in large part to the energy and coolness of Lieutenant Commander Truesdell. But it was sound and fury, signifying nothing. Her range setting was far short of the actual ranges on the Japanese, largely because the Japanese had turned off their searchlights, and her fire control equipment was fouled by her smoke and fire. Thus her first 11 8-inch salvos missed, mostly falling short. But the Japanese did not, and as they passed aft, the Kako and Kinugasa continued to give her a vicious lashing. At 2:02, the Kako's 25mm guns raked the Astoria's bridge, killing her helmsman and crippling her communications. A minute later, an 8-inch shell from the Kinugasa exploded on the well deck, again, and detonated a kerosene tank. Midships now became a firestorm, and dense smoke entered the after-engine room, forcing its abandonment. The ship slowed down. Captain Greenman realized they couldn't take much more of this pounding, and at 2:04 a.m., ordered to turn to port away from the Japanese. It was a fortuitous order, for at 2:05, the Kako launched another 2 torpedoes, which missed, again. But Japanese torpedoes were not the only things the Astoria had to avoid. As the cruiser had turned to port, she saw the Quincy, out of control and burning furiously, still turning to starboard, and about to cross in front of her in the opposite direction. Only a left full rudder averted a collision. A collision averted was small comfort, as the shells continued raining on the Astoria. Fire control was now a memory. Steering was lost from the bridge, and had to be moved to the main damage control station. She settled on a wobbly course to the south for all the good it would do. The forward engine room lost all power and was shut down, and the Astoria staggered to a halt. Then the gunfire stopped. Lieutenant Commander Truesdell was flabbergasted. Why the enemy did not completely destroy the Astoria that night is a mystery to me, as we had ceased firing, but for some reason they withdrew and did not come in for the kill. They certainly thought about it. The Kinugasa had turned her searchlight on the Astoria evidently to assess her damage. Defiantly, the Astoria got off one last salvo. 3 8-inch shells from turret 2 fired by local control. Naturally, they missed, instead flying over the intended target Kinugasa into the darkness beyond. One landed on the left side of the forward 8-inch turret on the Chokai, knocking it out of commission. Perhaps chastened a little, the Kinugasa shut off her searchlight, and the Japanese disappeared into the night. With them, two Allied cruisers were about to disappear. Two more were helpless, dead in the water, burning, and alone. While the Americans and Australians had been going through hell, the Japanese were virtually celebrating. By any standard, Admiral Mikawa's operation here had gone ludicrously well, due to an incredible streak of good luck combined with an incompetence bordering on criminal on the part of the enemy. So well that Mikawa was not so much a military commander as a symphony maestro. The searchlight on the Chokai was his baton. Captain Omai would later explain, "The Chokai's searchlights were used for the double purpose of spotting targets and also informing our own ships of the flagship's location. They were effective in both roles, fairly screaming to our colleagues, 'Here is the Chokai, fire on that target. Now that target. This is the Chokai, hit that target.'" Most symphonies don't have the audience shooting back at you, and for the most part this one did not as well. For incredible minutes, the turrets of enemy ships remained in their trained-in, secured positions, and we stood amazed, yet thankful, while they did not bear on us. Except Mozart never had to deal with his musicians running off in the middle of a performance. Admiral Mikawa did. His scratch force was now badly divided. Destroyer Yunagi was somewhere west of Savo Island. Tenryu, Yubari, and Furutaka were close to the northeastern coast of Savo, heading northwest. The other cruisers of the 6th Cruiser Division were further northeast, headed northwest as well. Mikawa's own flagship, Chokai, had wandered off further still to the east. This tends to happen at night. To make them an effective combat formation again, he had to get them back together. That would take time. Admiral Mikawa predicted that a half hour to slow down and assemble, a half hour to regain formation, a half hour to get back up to battle speed, and another hour to get to the transport anchorage would suffice. And all that time the clock was ticking, getting closer to dawn, when his cruisers would be as vulnerable to U.S. carrier planes as the hapless Mikuma and Mogami were during the retreat from Midway. He needed to get away fast, and hopefully draw the U.S. carriers into the range of the G-4M bombers at Rabaul. Admiral Mikawa still did not know where those carriers were located, and he was apparently beginning to think his intelligence information was inaccurate. He had not been told about the two picket destroyers west of Savo Island. He was surprised by the appearance of the northern group of U.S. cruisers. It seemed the Allies had warships everywhere, and he did not know where they were, did not even know where the transports were, for that matter. Had the reports of damage inflicted on the Allied ships by the 5th Air Attack Force been wrong? Finally, there was an emotional consideration. Admiral Mikawa was well aware of how far he had pressed his luck. He had been greatly impressed by the actions of the northern group of U.S. cruisers. Had they even had a few minutes' warning of our approach, the results of the action would have been quite different. They could have been different anyway, as that 8-inch shell from the Quincy came very close to killing the admiral. As it was, the Chokai had taken more of a beating than her consorts, with her forward 8-inch turret now disabled. Admiral Mikawa looked around him at the flaming ships and debris around Savo Island. It reminded him of the Water Lantern Festival at Lake Hakone. He was also reminded of the words of Admiral Nagano, who had opposed the Savo operation before Mikawa had left Japan. "The Japanese Navy is different from the American Navy. If you lose one ship, it will take years to replace." He was unwilling to press his luck further. The 17th Army had said the Americans could be easily pushed off Guadalcanal. Why risk his precious ships to sink non-combatant transports and supply ships? It was just not the Japanese way. "All forces withdraw," Admiral Mikawa ordered at 2:23 a.m. "Force in line ahead, course 320 degrees, speed 30 knots. There was considerable grumbling, especially from the Chokai skipper, Captain Hayakawa. Perhaps in protest, Captain Sawa Masao had the Kinugasa empty her starboard torpedo tubes at the transports off Tulagi, 13 miles away. The torpedoes missed, but no one would have been surprised if these long lances had hit. Nevertheless, the Aoba, Kako, and the Kinugasa complied, the Chokai trying to overtake them, but not trying too hard. The Aoba still had her charts easily accessible. Off to port, they could see the western